Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With us now is Jacqueline Woodson, perhaps best known for her 2014 book, Brown Girl Dreaming, a memoir of her childhood written in verse, which won the National Book Award. She grew up in South Carolina and Brooklyn in the 1960s and 70s, living with what she has called the remnants of Jim Crow and a growing awareness of the civil rights movement at that time. She says one of her first pieces of writing as a child was a poem about Martin Luther King that the adults around her couldn't believe she wrote because it was that good for a kid. Woodson has written about 30 books in all for children, adolescents, and adults. She's won many awards. Maybe you also know Another Brooklyn or Red at the Bone or If You Come Softly or one of her others. Jacqueline Woodson, thanks so much for joining us for Martin Luther King Day. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's so good to be back.
Can you tell us more about the poem about Dr. King that you wrote as a kid? You were born in 63, I believe, so I'm guessing he had already been assassinated by then?
No, King was assassinated in 68. And so, yeah, I thought you were saying 63. He was long assassinated by the time I wrote that poem, which was in the 70s when I was in the fifth grade. And it was, I remember the beginning of it, Black brothers, Black sisters, all of them were great. No fear, no fright, but a willingness to fight. In big fine houses live the whites and little old shacks live the Blacks. But the Blacks were smart and in fear they took no part. One of them was Martin with a heart of gold, not like white bigots with hearts colder than cold. And why I remember it so well is because I ended up having to recite it a bunch of times, but it goes on. But my clearest memory of it is that my teacher's one note, one editorial change was that I should say some white bigots, that I shouldn't say white bigots. And so I added the word some. And I was so stunned that it was getting attention, right? That she was paying attention to this poem. And then it went on to win an all-school contest at PS 106. And I won a Scrabble game. That was the prize. So
that's great and appropriate that it was a word game, I guess, in your case, right? Do you remember at that time, at that age, what it was about Dr. King as an individual or the movement in general that was most with you at that age?
I think by then the movement felt like it was in the far past, but it was part of the continuum. I was growing up where the Black Panthers were really loud and, you know, say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud, and all the Black pride that had come out of that part of the movement. So we were being taught about King and the civil rights movement in school. And it felt like something that had happened a long time ago. And even though, you know, I was born in the midst of it all happening, it didn't feel like it was something very present, but it felt like something that had a huge impact on who I was at that moment in Brooklyn. So it was we were always talking about King in school. We were celebrating him. Of course, it wasn't MLK Day wasn't a legal holiday yet, but there was a lot of attention paid to the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King and, of course, Rosa Parks.
And what you call in your bio the remnants of the Jim Crow South, which I guess refers to your first few years of childhood when you lived in Greenville, South Carolina. It was remnants, I guess, because it wasn't technically Jim Crow anymore. The Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act had been passed by then. But what are some of your memories of what you would call those remnants as you experienced them?
My grandmother would go to the back of the bus automatically. You know, that was the thing. She would just we would get on the bus and we would walk to the back of it. And I didn't understand at that point that that's what that was about. You know, she had grown up going to the back of the bus and that law, quote unquote, had been changed. But in terms of how physical bodies reacted to it, it was still there. There were certain stores that she would never go into that had not been, she had not been allowed to go into. And she's like, no, I'm not shopping there now that we are quote unquote, allowed to shop there. You know, there was still, we lived in Nickeltown. It was still completely segregated. And when you went downtown, that's when you saw Black and white folks engaging, not engaging, but in the same spaces.
So after your family moved to Brooklyn, you would go back and forth because your grandmother was still down in Greenville?
Yes. Yeah. And it was kind of the thing so many people who were part of the Great Migration did, right? Our families moved north, and in the summer we would go back to the place from whence we came and spend the time with the relatives there. So yeah, we would spend many summers in Greenville.
So was that like a jolt? Or, you know, we don't want to overestimate how not racist New York was, but was it a jolt as you would go back and forth?
It wasn't, because it was something I had always known. I mean, I grew up in Bushwick, which was predominantly Black and Latino. There were very few whites. It was at the, you know, it was during white flight. So white people were getting out of there. I wasn't engaging with a lot of white folks in Brooklyn either, excuse me, except my teachers mainly. And so the difference in Greenville was the cultural and the geographic difference, right? People said we talk like New Yorkers, and we're like, no, we talk like the people on television. So, but in terms of race, it didn't feel outside for me.
You said that as a kid prior to fifth grade, you liked to make up not just stories, but outright lies. Was that from having such an active imagination? The Jacqueline Woodson who would grow into the writer, or did you just want to get away with stuff?
Both. I think that's such a great question. It was both. I love telling stories. I love engaging with people that way and seeing the wonder that came when I had these fantastic stories that kept them listening to me. And it felt like my own life wasn't that interesting that I had to exaggerate it to make it something that would interest others. But I just love story, and I loved getting away with it. I love when I told crazy stories about what I'd done and people believed it, you know, and I guess I did it well back then.
Did you ever think of becoming a politician instead of a writer? No, I'm just kidding. You have written, for those who don't know your work, all kinds of stories about all kinds of people. You care about diversity and having different kinds of people, certainly young Black and brown characters, so kids of color can see themselves reflected in literature. You've talked about that. But I don't think you'd call yourself an activist exactly. Correct me if I'm wrong. But how do the ideas of writing for equity and writing for artistry intersect for you, if that's something you even think about?
I do consider myself an activist. I consider myself an activist through my writing, because it's a way of getting myself first to think about something other than what is, or other than you know, what we believe to be true all the time. I started writing because I love writing, but also I started writing books with people of color because I was growing up and those books weren't in our libraries, in our classrooms. And I didn't understand why my existence as a person of color was erased from literature. And so at that time, did I know that that was activism, that I was activated to do that? No, I didn't, but I knew I was upset about it, and I knew I wanted to change it. And I think when you look at what ignites people to do the work that they do to change the world, that's where it starts, right? That point of being, of something not feeling the way it should feel or being the way it should be. So, and I thought the idea of myself not in the world made me feel illegitimate, right? And I wanted the Black experience to be legitimate in the world, and writing it into the narrative would do that.
I see that just before the pandemic, you spent about 2 years going around to different places representing young people's literature, and you focused mainly on Title I schools, meaning schools with a large population of kids in poverty, and on juvenile detention centers. Why'd you pick those? I'm sure our viewers and listeners would love to hear about that.
So I was the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, a position that Jason Reynolds now holds. And you get to decide what your platform will be. And I decided it was going to be reading equals hope times change. And you read, you become hopeful, and you have the tools to change the world. I wanted to go into Title I schools and juvenile detention centers because I knew those were places where young people might not ever have the opportunity to meet a living writer and talk about craft, talk about story, talk about the importance of their own existences, their own bodies in the world. And it was amazing. I mean, I just met so many amazing young people in those spaces. And hopefully, you know, we'll hear from them. We'll see their books in the world at some point.
And I think it's a sign of your own openness that I saw you quoted saying, well, maybe you were there to teach them, but you also learn so much from them. Yes?
It is so true. It is so true. They're so wise. And I was talking to someone yesterday about the importance of just listening to young folks, right? They have so much to say, especially now. And for me to just be able to be in a space with them and open the dialogue in which they realize they're safe to speak, to talk about things that they might otherwise have not felt safe to talk about. I know when I was growing up, my uncle was incarcerated and we weren't allowed to talk about it. There was so much shame around it. I knew nothing about the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration, none of this. I just knew that my uncle was incarcerated. I knew other people who had family members that were incarcerated. And I realized so many of these young people had those similar experiences. So I'd go in there and read my book, Visiting Day, which is about a girl whose dad is in prison. And suddenly all these kids realize, oh, here's a green light. I can actually talk about this thing that I've been hiding and feeling ashamed about because I've set the tone, right? As the writer with the literature, with my own body, with a similar experience, I've said, okay, this is okay to talk about.
Here's a green light. What a great little phrase you dropped in there. You know, I think it's accurate to say we live in a time of activism for social justice, for racial justice, that's probably greater than anything since Martin Luther King's day, since the 1960s. Is it influencing either what you read or what you write in the last couple of years?
It's definitely made me think harder about the stories I want to read. I want to read stuff where people have something to say. I've never been engaged with stories where there's a whole lot of navel gazing anyway, but I am much more intentional about what I read. I feel like my time is shorter too. But in terms of my own writing, I've always been committed to social justice. So that hasn't changed so much. It's always been the challenge of finding the right language, finding the love language that people can hear. And I think now more than ever, there's so much noise, right? There's so much outside noise. And there's also the pushback against that love language and that pushback against social justice. So I do find myself being much more thoughtful and intentional about how I'm telling stories. And again, like I said, what I'm reading.
Jacqueline, one of the things going on these days, as I'm sure you know, might be called a war on writing, with attempts to censor the 1619 Project, what some people call critical race theory, even if they misinterpret entirely and sometimes willfully what it is. I wonder if you are feeling that as a writer, even either with respect to your own work or just as you look out at the world.
It's such a great question. I mean, first and foremost, I have to give my flowers to Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's holding down the fort on so much of the pushback and hatred she's getting for telling the truth. And I think that I have seen, you know, I'm censored in a lot of places. And one thing I think about is, if I was growing up today, would I have gotten all of the class learning I got about Martin Luther King Jr., right? Because people would say this is something that we don't want taught in our classrooms because it might make our white kids feel bad. And that's what the dialogue is, right? That's what the argument is. So books like The Story of Ruby Bridges are being struck from reading lists. Brown Girl Dreaming has been challenged. My book, Brown Girl, a couple of my books, but that one was surprising to me in that it's about American history and people are pushing back against American history told from the points of view of the non-white bodies that lived it. So it's exhausting. I mean, but the work has always been exhausting. And I think the only thing I can say is we have to keep speaking up. We have to keep reading those books. We have to keep demanding them in our classrooms. We have to get on the school boards because, people on school boards are getting threatened. Their lives are getting threatened for bringing a book like The Story of Ruby Bridges into the classroom. It's bananas, but it makes perfect sense because when this kind of change is happening, people get very fearful. And we see in this that words and books are very powerful. And for me as a writer, I just want the books to get into the hands of the young people who need them so that they have the tools for understanding the context of the world they're living in now. So it's heartbreaking and it's exhausting. And it's exciting because it's about we know where the struggle is, we know where the fight is, and we know the work that we need to do to make this country better.
Do you have any story of engaging with a particular school district or whoever it would be over an attempt to ban Ruby Bridges or Brown Girl Dreaming or anything?
A friend of mine in Long Island was on her school board when they were talking about taking Brown Girl Dreaming off the list, and she was able to be there to fight against it. That's the thing about it. We don't know where books are getting challenged or taken off of shelves or out of classrooms because we're not there and they're not getting the press, right? If some school in a small town in upstate New York decides to pull every book by a non-white author off the shelf and no one is there to speak out, we don't know. But I remember when from the Notebooks of Melon and Son, and this is years ago, it was given out to a whole school and some parent complained about it. This is one of my books. And the teacher, the principal over the PA system said everyone had to bring their book back and return it. And they got two books back. So out of like 150. And so I think that sense of someone saying you can't do this or you shouldn't do this is of course sometimes going to make people want to do it more. But if the books don't even make it as far as the hands of the young people, then how can they ever begin to push back against the pushback?
Before you go, do you want to say anything about your brand new book just released this month, The Year We Learned to Fly?
I have to drop Virginia Hamilton's name, who is a wondrous and wonderful writer. And I do feel like The Year We Learned to Fly would not be here without her book, The People Could Fly. And it's a story about kids getting themselves free by using their imagination. So we're back to the beginning of this interview.
And with the beginning, we end. Jacqueline Woodson, thank you so much for participating in our Martin Luther King birthday celebration.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to talk to you.